Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank. King Arthur is enormously popular for a guy that probably didn't exist. You're thinking, wait, what are you talking about? How could a guy who's had so many movies based off of his legend, so many medieval tales, so many appearances in works of fiction not exist? The reason I say that with pretty good confidence is I have a guest, Professor Dorsey Armstrong, who's a professor at Purdue, who looks into Arthurian legends and examines why the greatest king who ever lived probably didn't live. Scholars refer to Arthur as an Arthur-type figure, someone who may have existed around the 5th century in the Wales area and protected people from the Anglo-Saxon onslaught, but his cause ultimately failed after a few generations because the Anglo-Saxons came to control all of England. But that doesn't stop Arthur from taking on this mythical status, and his myth is joined by knights and ladies and becomes one of the most enduring popular mythic traditions of Western civilization. For over 1,500 years, he's appeared in works of art, mosaics, novels, movies, and his appeal continues on to today. Even this summer, there was a Guy Ritchie movie about the Arthurian legend, what Dorsey calls Excalibro, a bro-like figure who's pretty rough, kind of like a Cockney guy who manages to brawl his way all the way up to the throne. And then there was also the Clive Owen movie that came out 10 years ago. There's the famous Camelot musical that came out in the 60s, and Arthur has appeared all over the place. So in this interview, we talk about who the historical Arthur might have been, when his legend really starts to kick off thanks to Geoffrey and Monmouth, and then how he becomes the symbol of courtly love and chivalry in the 1200s in France, the myth of the Holy Grail, Camelot, and why Arthur is such a timeless, enduring legend, even though the real version of Arthur might have been this kind of rough country bumpkin guy who is more of a warlord in 500s England. Anyway, enjoy this interview with Dorsey Armstrong. She does a great job of jumping back and forth between Arthur and pop culture and the actual Arthur. I enjoyed it, and I hope you do too. Dorsey, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Because we're going to talk all about Arthur in popular culture from the Middle Ages until now, we're fortunate that we have a new Arthur movie that just came out, the one directed by Guy Ritchie. But we were talking before I hit record that there's another one starring Clive Owen that came out about 10 years ago. So let's start off with that. Which one is better, the Guy Ritchie one or the Clive Owen one?
It's like comparing apples to oranges, and I wouldn't say that one is better than the other, but I would say they both have moments in which they get the idea of Arthur right by getting some historical facts, shall we say, completely wrong. So, for example, in the Clive Owen King Arthur, what's interesting about that film is that it decides to go with an Arthur who, from the time he is a young boy, is told, you are going to be in charge of these men someday. You have a responsibility to them. And when we first heard it was coming out, Arthurian scholars were very excited because it was going to be set in the 5th century, which is the correct time for an historical Arthur, if one did exist. Setting it at Hadrian's Wall, not necessarily the standard choice. We disagreed with that. They went with a Sarmatian element, where that the idea that Arthur's knights have been conscripted into the Roman army. That's not usually held to be a valid theory by most Arthurian scholars, but we were excited that it was set in the 5th century and there was a connection to Rome, because a lot of the earliest texts suggest that whoever this Arthur-type figure was, what he was doing was trying to restore civilization in the face of the Roman withdrawal from Britain. And so this Arthur, the Clive Owen Arthur, is so good and noble from the beginning. He is always trying to do the right thing, and his struggle comes from maintaining loyalties that end up being conflicted. He is loyal to what he imagines the state of Rome, the Empire of Rome, stands for, and its ideals, but he's also very loyal to his men, and they are utterly loyal to him, even when he's so busy being good that he's going to put them all in danger. So there are plenty of moments where they've got to go because the Saxons are coming or someone's going to attack. But Clive Owen looks around, and I always like to say that his Arthur can smell injustice at 100 paces. And he says, "Wait, something's happening over here." He goes to fix whatever is wrong. And his knights, they roll their eyes. They say, "Come on, Arthur, we've got to go. You can't save everybody." But then at the same time, they're utterly loyal. And so they go and they do what he says. And he is always freeing people, righting wrongs, but in a way that would ring true and be inspiring to a modern audience, but would be absolutely incorrect for the reality of the 5th century. So that movie gets the idea of Arthur as someone who's good and does the right thing, gets it right by getting it wrong, if that makes sense. The other Arthur movie, the more recent one with Guy Ritchie directing, takes a completely different approach to Arthur. So instead of being this fully formed noble character who's having to negotiate between loyalties to his men and to his country, he is this diamond in the rough, doesn't know his parentage, grows up in a brothel, is like a mischievous ruffian, who is getting into all kinds of scrapes with his buddies. We like to call it Excalibro, actually.
That's good.
Because it's all about a group of guys, and Arthur's sort of their leader, and, you know, they're not exactly engaged in above-the-board activities, but they're making their way in the world, you know, through their wits, until Arthur finds out who he is and that he's in fact the son of the king. And then he's got to negotiate between his identities. Who am I? Am I this guy who is just a peasant boy, or am I the potential king of this nation? And that movie actually ended up being a lot of fun. All the Arthurian scholars I know were dreading it. We thought, oh no, this is going to be terrible. And the number one Arthurian film critic in the world today, Kevin Hardy, actually texted some of us from the theater, which you're not supposed to do, but he went to see it on opening day, and he said, you know what? It's not terrible. It is really just good fun. It's not purporting to tell the true story. It's offering a version of it that keeps some of the details consistent, and it's an interesting play on the major themes of the Arthurian story. He said it's a good movie. So it's interesting that the critics didn't like it. When I went to see it, I couldn't figure out why the critics didn't like it. It seemed like a perfectly good, fun movie to me. And interestingly, all the Arthurian scholars who thought they were going to hate it ended up enjoying it in spite of themselves.
Huh. Okay. That's very interesting. I've thought about on this podcast of having a segment called Hollywood Hates History, because so often they get things terribly wrong. And
indeed they do.
Well, yeah, like what you were saying earlier with Clive Owen, where he's a little bit too high-minded for the period. And I think the film that violates this worst is Kingdom of Heaven, the Orlando Bloom Crusades movie, where it's what would happen if a socially conscious 21st century cosmopolitan, well-heeled, vegan young man went back to the Crusades to show Muslims and Christians tolerance. So, but that's surprising to hear that they get some things right. Okay.
They get some elements of the story right. They're not at all pretending to be historically accurate. And so then I forgive them a lot because they're not purporting to tell the true story. Whereas the Clive Owen King Arthur was attempting to argue that they were telling a true story, in which case I don't understand why Guinevere was wearing a leather bikini and why Saxons were north of Hadrian's Wall, and also for that matter why, you know, Hadrian's Wall was built because the people who were north of it were so scary that the Romans said, we're not even messing with these people. We are just building a wall and we are staying down here. But in the film, there's a Roman family that has apparently a vacation house up there, and they have to be rescued. I don't know what they're doing there. None of that makes any sense. Also, all medievalists will tell you that we have to shut off the critique-o-meter, especially when it comes to stirrups, because there is not a stirrup to be found in 5th and 6th century Europe. But I understand, do you want to put the people on the horses? And unless you've got some really skilled bareback riders, you're going to have to give some people some stirrups so they can do their scenes on horseback. Well, and Hollywood loves a good scene on horseback.
Yeah, that's sometimes we have to choose our battles. Now, something that is fascinating is these are two movies within 10 years of each other, and I don't know how many movies are. There's the famous musical Camelot from the 60s. And
there are so many movies.
And then, of course, probably one of the best fictional accounts in the Middle Ages are Arthurian legends. Going back all the way to this historical figure that we don't know that much about. So let's start at the beginning with who was Arthur, if he did in fact exist, and what are elements of the earliest sources that evolve into this whole canon of Arthurian legend?
Well, one thing we can say is, first of all, our documentary evidence for there being, and again, we have to call him an Arthur-type figure, although there is some suggestion that whoever this person was might have had a name that was something like Arthur. Artus, Arturius, some sort of Romanized version of a Celtic name, perhaps. The earliest sources and the ones that are the most convincing, one of them is a poem called Ygodolvyn, and it has a passage in which it talks about this great warrior guy, Gwarthur. And this poem dates from the year 600 or so. And it talks about how awesome Gwarthur is. He's just killing his enemies left and right. But at the same time that he's super awesome, there's just this throwaway line that says, yeah, but he was no Arthur. Hmm. So already the suggestion is that in the cultural consciousness, there's a guy called Arthur who is renowned for doing amazing things. And we don't need to explain who he is because everybody knows. The other problem here is that the sources we're working with are most certainly not the only sources that existed at one time. So we are probably missing all kinds of stuff that might fill in the blanks. So you have to be careful because a lot of the texts that list, say, the number of battles Arthur fought, where he fought them, to whom he was married, they date centuries after the historical figure, but they probably are referencing earlier works that are now lost. They're copies of works that we don't have anymore, but we can't check them, so we don't know. One of the best pieces of evidence would be the 6th century regnal lists, so lists of kings. And we do know that in the 6th century, in 4 royal houses in Britain, firstborn sons were born, and so presumably they're going to be the next king, and they were all named Arthur, which is a name that we don't see anywhere in the records before this.
Hmm.
So it suggests that's a good thing to be naming the heir to the throne. And there's archaeological evidence from the period that shows that somebody, and again, we got to say Arthur-type figure, and it might have been two somebodies, but someone right around the right time for Arthur managed to stop the Anglo-Saxon invasion of Britain and in some cases push the Saxons back, and that for a couple of generations, maybe right around the year 500, to the west, which we consider sort of Arthurian territory, people's villages were not getting burned and razed on a regular basis. They got the crops in. There was a period of peace and stability. The problem is, this is in the period right after the Romans have pulled out of Britain. We call this sub-Roman Britain, or some scholars call it the Brittonic period.
Okay.
And when the Romans leave, they take with them all their lovely bureaucracy and record-keeping, and in their absence, all of these pagan, illiterate peoples descend upon the island. You've got Angles, Saxons, Jutes, Frisians, Picts, Scots. They're all attacking a people who had enjoyed the status of Roman citizens for almost 400 years, who suddenly find themselves with no defense. They'd been Christianized. They'd been civilized. And so at this point, no one is really writing stuff down. People are just trying to survive. A good example that shows this is that there's a hill fort called Cadbury Castle that originally dates from the pre-Roman period. And when the Romans came in and took over Britain, they pretty quickly, in sort of the south and the west and the central part of Britain, managed to conquer the land south of Hadrian's Wall. They didn't quite make it all the way through Wales, and Ireland they didn't make it to. And they set up these sort of reproductions, this mini Rome. They built roads, they installed bureaucracy, there are baths, there are coliseums. And so these hill forts that had been Celtic strongholds were abandoned. Right around the right time for Arthur, the hill fort, ancient hill fort that has traditionally been called Cadbury Hill or Camelot, was refortified on a massive scale. At the top of this hill fort, there are, if you go to the top and you can see from the air, there are these earthen ramparts. Archaeological evidence shows that there was a very thick timber wall that encircled the top, sort of flat part of this hill fort, and that the population living there, estimates are between 700 to 1,000 people. And this is right around the same time that we estimate your average Celtic war band would be about 35 people. And when this happened, when the first archaeological digs were done here, everyone assumed this makes sense. We bet you all the people in Britain were retreating to ancient hill forts to protect themselves from the Saxons. And so they assumed that they would find this all over Britain. But in fact, so far as I know, no, just this one. And it's just the one that's traditionally been called Camelot. And it's in the right place, and it's at the right time. Again, we have no evidence of the name of the war leader, who must have been really charismatic and a skilled warrior to get all these people to rally to his side and to sort of organize this society in the face of what was utter chaos at the time. But it's suggestive. And you, so you can see how these little pieces on their own don't necessarily give credence to the existence of the Arthur-type figure. But when you put them all together, I tend to be of the opinion that there was somebody who did something really awesome, and he helped his people, and the memory of that was so compelling that the stories got passed down, and then they grew and grew and grew over time.
Okay, so there is a person, and also this Arthur-like figure, when he is called a king by some people, but it's definitely not at that level based on what you're describing, a ruler, what realm would he have ruled over, most likely? And who would he have been ruling over? Is it the Britons or some other group?
It would be probably, our guess would be, people who had been Romanized Britons. So they would be Celtic peoples who had considered themselves Roman citizens. He may have then allied himself with some fringe Celtic groups that had managed to evade Roman domination. And he wasn't necessarily a ruler. I don't think he would have been called king. More like some of the texts call him a dux valorum, which is a war leader. Or a comes, a count, or like a Roman leader. But the word king, rex, doesn't get used about Arthur until maybe possibly, if we can believe the evidence from his supposed grave, which was found in 1191 at Glastonbury Abbey, at the end of his life. And so these would be people who were Romanized and were resisting the Anglo-Saxons. And we all know how that story ends because you and I are speaking English and not some version of Welsh. If Arthur had ultimately been victorious in the long term, we'd be speaking some sort of Celtic language right now. But the Anglo-Saxons brought with them what we call Old English, which has evolved into the language we're using today. So they eventually were victorious, even though Arthur stopped them, or the Arthur-type figure, for a couple generations.
Okay, now, and this is really interesting because after his death, after this figure that we know very little about, or even if it's one person, then there's a kernel of a legend that starts to grow, and you start to see reference to him in Latin texts. Now, what's weird is that he's being referenced by the people that he would have fought against, these Anglo-Saxon figures. And I think you mentioned that there's Gildas in the 6th century and Nennius in the 9th century and yes. Welsh accounts. So how does this legend start to grow? And why do you think this figure seems so important to chroniclers that they want to mention him?
Well, I think simply because there are so many blanks and gaps, he's kind of like a placeholder onto which every age can project what they need and what their ideal ruler is. And that is what every age did. And in the case of the most famous chronicler of Arthur, which happens centuries later in 1136, this guy called Geoffrey of Monmouth, he may have been trying in writing his history of the kings of Britain, he may have been trying to curry favor with the Norman invaders. So we got to remember the Normans invade in 1066. So he has a few invasions. It's helpful to back up. The Romans definitively conquer most of what we think of as Britain today in the first century. Then in the middle of the 5th century, we have the Anglo-Saxon invasion, which is after the Romans have pulled out and gone back because Rome got sacked by a bunch of Goths. And so the empire was spread too thin. And then we have another invasion in 1066, which is the Normans, who were actually cousins of the Anglo-Saxons, but they did this weird thing where they set up a base of operations in France and within a couple generations decided to stop being Germanic and become French, even though they remembered that they were still cousins with these Anglo-Saxons across the Channel. And when William the Conqueror crossed the Channel, he supposedly had with him Breton bards singing songs of Arthur.
Huh.
Now, the Bretons, yes, the Bretons are the Britons who, in the face of the Saxon invasion, got the heck out of Britain and went across the Channel to the part of France that's now called Brittany. And they settled there, and their language is actually nothing like French. It's much closer to Welsh. And what William was capitalizing on in terms of propaganda is he was going to have these Breton bards who identified as native British going back centuries supporting William in his attempt to take control of Britain. And there was some sort of logical move here that people were trying to argue it was as if the kingdom of Arthur was going to be restored because those Anglo-Saxons, they were interlopers. And so William was going to fix it. And so he was capitalizing on the Arthurian theme in order to sort of promote himself as the rightful occupier of the British throne, which at this point was the English throne.
Wow, I have to give William credit there for his historical acumen with the Breton singing. I was thinking, what would be in a corollary? It'd be like if Mexico were invading South Carolina and had a group of Cherokees with them to sing loudly as a way of, we're bringing with us the original occupants of this land to properly reclaim it, something like that.
That might be, so not exact, but that's a pretty good parallel, I think, to try and explain how William was justifying his conquest of England. Now, the other way he justified it was he said, excuse me, but Edward the Confessor named me his heir because he didn't have any children because we were cousins, and he named me his heir upon his death, and his brother-in-law has now claimed the throne, which he's not supposed to be doing. So I got to go and take it back.
Well, this text here, Geoffrey and Monmouth's, from what I know of Arthurian legend, this is really the touchstone where a lot of the legends spring from. But this is interesting because, so I'm not a medievalist. I studied the Ottoman Empire. But I think we have some similar challenges where a lot of our understanding of the most important figures come from texts written hundreds of years after the fact. And a lot of times these texts aren't about the time period in question, they're really about the date of which the text was written, and they're projecting those issues back in time. And we do this, yes, in the modern era, like we mentioned the Kingdom of Heaven movie, we're taking 21st century multiculturalism and projecting it back to the Crusades. But Can you talk about Geoffrey of Monmouth's history of the kings of Britain? Because there's a lot, this is where a lot of issues come out. So why were certain issues of the Arthurian legend discussed at that time? What were those issues? And why do you think Geoffrey brought them up?
Well, what's really interesting is Geoffrey claims, and for a long time Arthurian scholars have figured he's just making this up. Geoffrey says, I am writing this text at the request of Archdeacon Walter, who has given me this book, which is written in a very ancient British tongue, so presumably something like Welsh, and it tells the history of the kings of Britain. And what's important to know here is that Geoffrey's book is not mainly about Arthur. It is about the history of Britain, and it starts well before Arthur with the kings who came before him. Arthur is arguably, he takes up the most space in the book, but there's also kings that come after him. So it truly is not just an Arthurian story. It's supposedly a history, a chronicle of the kings of Britain before the Anglo-Saxons and those who sort of tried to hold power in the face of the Anglo-Saxon invasion after Arthur's death. And so Geoffrey says, I am translating this book out of Welsh, or whatever this ancient British tongue is, probably something like Welsh, into Latin, because Latin was a language of learning, and therefore I'm going to make it accessible to everybody. Everyone should know this history. Now, a lot of times you'll come across Arthurian scholars who say, there's no evidence that this existed before, and Geoffrey made it up out of whole cloth. I tend not to think so, because in the Middle Ages, the definition of originality and good writing was not to make up a brand new story that no one had ever heard, but to take material that already existed and reshape it in clever ways. So if Geoffrey made up this entire history of the kings of Britain, I think one scholar who agrees with me has said, well, then he has to be the most incredible creative writer the medieval world had ever seen. So I think he probably was working with something. It might not have been one book. It might have been several texts that he sort of was unstitching and rearranging and putting back together. But I don't think he was simply making it up. And, of course, I'm going to say the thing that I always have to say, which is, and that book, whatever it is lost.
Yeah.
Those books are gone. But in this case, we meet an Arthur who's definitely a ruler. He looks like a 12th century king. He has a great court. He has power. And Geoffrey of Monmouth is the first to connect Arthur to the figure of Merlin. So Merlin is not a part of the Arthurian legend before the 12th century. There is a 6th century Welsh bard called Myrddin, who was probably the basis or the inspiration for Merlin. But this idea that the historical Arthur, whoever he was, had this wizard hanging around helping him out, that didn't come into being until Geoffrey of Monmouth in the 12th century. And the reason that the Arthurian legend then explodes after that is Geoffrey's text became incredibly popular. And we know that in terms of surviving manuscripts, it got copied, it got translated into vernacular languages. It's found in archives on the other side of the channel, on the continent, and over 200 manuscript copies survive. And these are 12th century. And if you think about that, you might think that's not so many. Do you know how many copies of Chaucer's Canterbury Tales we have that survive, which is from a couple centuries later and much better known? You have maybe something like 80. So there were probably more copies. It was a bestseller in its time, and this is what inspired all kinds of writers, interestingly enough, mostly the French, to take the Arthurian legend and add to it, expand it, especially in terms of stories of individual knights and their exploits.
Now, I want to ask two other things about that. First of all, with Merlin, he as an archetype, I've seen it in a lot of places, the wise magus who guides the hero on his quest. And in our modern version, we have Gandalf, we have Dumbledore. But biblical
scholars... Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Kenobi. But even biblical scholars would say this is an ancient trope with the nativity story. You have the three wise men of the Orient, the Magi. And does Merlin serve any other purpose besides being this great stock figure in fiction?
Merlin is really interesting. And there are some scholars who've started to do work just on Merlin because it's hard to figure out in some cases what exactly his goal is, whose side is he on, and he doesn't necessarily fit any categories that you typically find at a chivalric court. And his use of magic would suggest that he's got access to all this information, and yet he's supposedly there to help Arthur, but when Arthur needs key information like, hey, this woman that you're going to sleep with tonight, she's actually your half-sister, so maybe don't do that because the product will be the incestuously conceived Mordred, who's a bad guy. And Merlin knows, but he just doesn't bother to fill Arthur in. So in some instances, he serves as a guide, and he tells Arthur, no, 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 here's how you have a feast day, here are the things that need to happen, here's what you should do, and gives him helpful guidance. And then in other instances, he utterly fails at his task and doesn't manage to do what we might consider the most helpful thing for Arthur and his kingdom. So he's really kind of a mystery, and I think in so many stories, he disappears early on. He gets walled up in a cave or imprisoned inside a tree or banished or something, just because I think the story doesn't know exactly what to do with him. So he disappears. He offers some advice. He causes some problems. He fixes some, and then he's gone.
Okay. Yeah, he's a mysterious guy. One other thing with Jeffrey, you said that you don't believe he's inventing this story whole cloth. He has access to some sources, which, you know, popular historian refrain, the original sources are lost.
Yep.
Where do you think he's getting his manuscripts? Is he going to, I don't know, Welsh monasteries and going through their dusty archives, or maybe listening to oral accounts that are popular?
He was in Oxford at the time. So he came from Wales. There's some evidence that he might have actually been from a Breton family, maybe. But he's in England, and he says he gets his books from Walter, Archdeacon of Oxford. And so that would be a place where that would be a scriptorium where there would be plenty of manuscripts. Or when I say plenty, a really impressive library in the Middle Ages would be something like 300 manuscripts.
Right.
That would be huge. And I would say that's probably the place he's getting any texts that he has access to. But there's also plenty of oral tradition surrounding Arthur. And so he may be using some of that. But, of course, the problem with oral tradition is we don't have any evidence. There's no one's going around tape recording the old people in the villages and their stories in the year, you know, 1120.
Right. And then it's filtered through one person. And I wonder, a big question that people have for these medieval or early modern writers or chroniclers is, was there patronage? Did he have any sort of political aim when he's writing it? Is he trying to please somebody for some purpose?
Oh, good heavens, yes. He writes a couple. He has more than one dedication. And he's dedicating this work on more than one occasion. Twice he dedicates it at different times to high-ranking nobles, especially among the Normans, to please them, right? He wants their patronage. So, oh, no, he's no dummy. He's definitely trying to get some of these high-ranking people to think that he sees them as, say, a new Arthur, which is why he dedicates this to them. That kind of thing. And that's a very typical trope. That's very common for a writer to do, to, you know, very publicly dedicate a work to someone and then extol their virtues and say, and here's the story of Arthur, which is fitting for you. So, but he does that on more than one occasion. So he is actually very politically savvy.
So it always makes these,
what he's doing.
It's always what makes these sources tricky, because in one sense, a chronicler, it's kind of like the press spokesman for a president, where
yes,
they're dealing with information, but are you really going to trust them as your sole source? And yeah, it makes it tough.
Yeah, it is. It's tricky.
So if I understand kind of where this legend evolves with the Knights of the Round Table and Guinevere and Lancelot, does that get tacked on in France, or does that still happen in England?
Well, there are some Welsh texts. They're later copies, but we're pretty sure that they're copies of earlier legit Welsh texts that suggest that Arthur had a wife named Guinevere. The Welsh version of her name would be Gwenhwyfar. If you're going to go back to the Welsh, the characters you are allowed to have in an Arthurian legend would be Arthur, Sir Kay, Guinevere, Gawain, Arthur's nephew, who's called Gwalchmai in Welsh, and Sir Bedivere. Lancelot bursts onto the scene fully formed in the 12th century in the work of French writer Chrétien de Troyes. He is so fully formed that I like to believe there must have been some oral stories circulating or some texts that had him as a character that we've lost, and that Chrétien seized upon him. Perhaps he was a minor character. And because, of course, Arthur is a British king and the French are the ones who love the legend, they really had to do something to, you know, make themselves feel good about this Arthurian legend. So they made Arthur's greatest knight a French guy, Lancelot. It's very possible that Chrétien de Troyes was getting his information, again, from the Bretons, who, again, were still in contact with their distant relatives back in Britain, the Britons. There was still contact back and forth. So there's some question as to whether or not some of these stories that were circulating orally were back and forth across the channel, and that Chrétien knew of them, and that's how Lancelot sort of gets finally written down. He may have existed in some form before that, but he just brings to life, comes off the page as if everyone knows he's the greatest guy ever in the history of knights. And so I find it hard to believe, again, like Geoffrey, that Chrétien would have just completely made him up out of whole cloth.
Is he part of this whole kind of movement of the courtly love in France? Sort of, what's the cart and what's the horse? Did the Arthurian legends come about that created this whole sensation of courtly love, or was this already a robust genre and then the Arthurian legend took on a lot of these tropes?
So Geoffrey of Monmouth is the very first writer that we know of in the Arthurian tradition who explicitly links the sort of engine of knightly endeavor to love of the feminine. And he says in a passage, he says, "The women at Arthur's court refused to love a knight until he had proven himself three times in battle. And because of this, the knights were more valiant and the ladies were more chaste." So that's 1136. And I think if we're talking about the Arthurian legend, that's what we can point to definitely, is here is the start of what, for better or worse, we would call courtly love. And then, yes, it blossoms from there. It sort of takes on a life of its own. Other things are happening. So it's not just in the Arthurian tradition, but this is a new sort of focus in literary works right around this time. And the Arthurian legend is just one of the kinds of texts that does this and does it emphatically. But that's the starting point, and it grows from there.
Right. And then Lancelot has his own little side quest. I think it's in the 13th century. There's a work that talks about his great exploits, and then the Holy Grail quest works its way in here. What's the reason for the legend then taking on these new embellishments?
I like to think of the Arthurian legend as this giant magnet.
Oh, yeah.
And it attracts to itself all kinds of other bodies of literature that were just fine on their own, but hey, we could fold this into the Arthurian legend. So, for example, the idea of the Holy Grail. Let's make that a quest for Arthur's knights. That sounds like a good idea. The same goes for any of the individual knights who have great exploits. Well, let's enhance them and enhance the story of Arthur by making this great guy also a knight of the Round Table. We see that in particular with Sir Tristram. He had his own, the Tristan story is very ancient, probably has Celtic origins, and was its own thing for a really long time before someone said, hey, let's make Tristan part of this Round Table. Let's give him a Grail quest. And there are so many different versions of the Grail quest. Some are very religious and allegorical in nature. Some are like any other quest, like a secular quest where you go out and hunt for an object to retrieve it, to show your valor. So it's really interesting. The Grail, like Arthur, can sort of be anything you need it to be. And the Arthurian legend can, it's so huge, it can encompass all kinds of adventures, any number of adventures, because after the initial developments of the story, so Arthur is conceived, he's born, he comes to power, he establishes his court. Well, from then on, it can just expand exponentially because you just have knights who go out while Arthur stays at home, and they have adventures, and then they come back and report those adventures to court. But they're all part of the Arthurian tradition.
And I think I forgot, the Round Table, does that also idea form in France?
Yeah, the first mention of the Round Table, I think, is also the 12th century. Something's going on in the 12th century. And I believe it's mentioned by the Anglo-Norman writer Wass. And it doesn't show up before then. And so, yeah, that's really interesting that we don't see it. But that doesn't mean that it didn't exist as part of the popular folklore surrounding Arthur prior to that. It's just that the first written evidence we have comes from Wass in the 12th century.
Okay. Well, man, there are so many different time periods that we could look at when the new Arthur iterations come about. There's, I mean, the Renaissance, there's other parts in the Middle Ages, Victorian, and you go over all of these things. So, I don't even know which one to go at. So maybe I should just ask you to choose one. What's a time period after his identity sort of coalesces in the Middle Ages that you think is really interesting that, I don't know, either add something to the Arthurian legend or maybe said something about the time period based on how they portray him? Which period on Arthur do you really like?
By far, I would say the most important period in terms of the Arthurian legend is the 15th century, and it's the text written by Sir Thomas Malory, the Mort d'Arthur, because Malory is the first writer of the Middle Ages to take the story of Arthur, which exists in all of these manuscripts. I mean, in French, we call it the Vulgate and post-Vulgate cycle, because there's so many, and they're all penned by different people, and some of them tell the story of Arthur's birth and focus on Merlin. Some of them focus on the quest for the Holy Grail. Some of them attempt to tell sort of the middle portion of the story or the end of the story. And what Malory does in the late 1460s, when he's in prison, actually, for some very unknight-like behavior, and this is during the Wars of the Roses, he decides, you know what, I'm going to take the Arthurian legend and I am going to collect and collate all of these different sources. I'm going to pick and choose, and I'm going to tell the story of Arthur from the beginning to the end and the aftermath, and it is the most coherent, comprehensive, and consecutively ordered single-author treatment of the Arthurian legend before the modern period, and this is the version that puts the definitive stamp on the story. He included everything he possibly could, all the adventures of as many knights as he possibly could. He's got Lancelot. He includes the story of Arthur's fight against Rome, which had existed in some other manuscripts. He's got the Holy Grail. He's got the Lancelot-Guinevere love affair. He has everything, but it's all ordered in a more or less logical fashion that makes it arguably, I would say, one of the first novels in the fact that it's a unified text, that it's trying to tell a certain story from the beginning to the end and include all the parts that make it relevant.
Do you think that this has something to do with the Renaissance, this kind of rediscovery of origins, and maybe have a figure to guide through this period?
In Mallory's case, what I think happened is he's in prison, and he's in prison because during the Wars of the Roses, knights and other nobles very often turned their coats. The throne was moving back and forth quite frequently between the families of York and Lancaster, basically a bunch of cousins fighting over the English throne. And I think I like to imagine what Mallory was thinking was, you know, if we had followed or were living by the standards that existed in Arthur's day, this wouldn't be happening. Society would not be in such a disarray. And so what he does is he's like, all right, I'm going to write this book. And what he adds to the legend is something that's not been there before, which is an oath that once Arthur becomes king and after he's married Guinevere, he makes his knights swear an oath that has all these clauses. A knight needs to grant mercy. He cannot commit treason. He has to help ladies. It's got all these rules, and this seems to be Mallory's original contribution to the legend. And most scholars agree it's probably his idea of how chivalry is supposed to work. And he puts that near the beginning of his text. And then I actually argue this in a couple of my own books and a couple articles, that what he's doing with the rest of the text is testing out the oath to see how it works in a variety of different circumstances, which is one reason why I think when he chose to tell the story of the Grail, he's like, I'm going to go for something that's really different in tone than what I've been writing about so far. So I'm going to go for a really spiritually, theologically oriented Grail story. And he does, and he tries to test the oath out there. And it's almost comical because poor Lancelot on that Grail quest is doing his damnedest to be a good knight. But the rules for a quest like this are completely different compared to all the other quests that Lancelot has excelled in throughout his career. And so what we find out on the Grail quest is, all right, this oath doesn't necessarily work to order society. And it has other flaws and other times in the text where, for example, the rule to serve ladies doesn't tell you what to do if the lady then asks you to cut off another knight's head, because that would not be very chivalric behavior. And it seems to be just because she asked first and you said you'd serve the lady, that you got to do what she says. So the oath is both too specific, too general, and not specific enough. It doesn't give enough guidance. But what's interesting is that if you try to adhere to it, you're going to do a better job being a knight than if you don't. And at the end of the story, when Arthur's kingdom collapses in Mallory, the sense we get is that it's really an unavoidable tragedy. There's nothing anyone could have done, given the way society is structured. But the attempt to try and live better and to try and follow the oath is still something that should be honored and extolled, and that it was worth the effort. It was a noble effort to try, even though this experiment failed. The trying was still worth it.
And I think at this time period, definitely, people assumed that Arthur was real. I think if I remember, knights had the nine noble ones, mighty ones, I forget their name, where you had the three Jewish knights, the three...
The nine worthies.
The nine worthies, yes. It was what, Alexander...
So you have the...
You'll know better,
You have the worthies from classical antiquity. You have the worthies from Jewish tradition. And then you have the three Christian worthies. And the three Christian worthies are Charlemagne, King Arthur, and Godfrey de Bologna.
Right, from the Crusades.
Yes, from the Crusades.
People, I mean, they're obviously looking up to them as these real figures. So was Arthur, I'm guessing Arthur was always assumed to be real, Camelot. So when did people start to question if he wasn't what the legend said. Do we have to get all the way up to the modern period for that?
No, I think there was probably some questioning by some people all along. But yes, he becomes more a figure of fiction, I would say, entering the, let's say, post-Shakespeare, to be safe. So the later part of the early modern period, I would say, is when he starts to be treated more as a fictional character rather than an historical one, although there will always have been and will be people who desperately believe in the real Arthur and that he did specific things X, Y, and Z. And there is a guy now who claims to be the reincarnation of Arthur.
Hey, why
not? And he's a druid. Yeah, and he's legally changed his name to Arthur Uther Pendragon. He was the leader of a motorcycle gang, and now I couldn't make this up. His number one cause in life right now is to defend Stonehenge from the National Heritage, who's trying to like make access to the site better. You know, he claims this as a sacred space. It is mentioned in the Arthurian legend. I'm guessing that if he claims to be the reincarnation of Arthur, he might also be the reincarnation of someone who was alive at the time of the building of Stonehenge, which, you know, they keep pushing further back in time. I think we're at like 2000 BC now, 2500 BC, when they think Stonehenge was built. But it does figure. It's an important place in the Arthurian legend. So there's always going to be true believers, and there's always going to be those who think he's not real at all, and probably, you know, the truth is somewhere in the middle. It's possible that other manuscripts could be found that would give us some more information, could turn up. You can always hope something's been lost in an archive, has been put in the wrong place, just waiting for someone to find it, or it's in someone's attic or personal private collection and they don't know what they have. But, you know, what's interesting is that I think we can say, you know, Milton, before he wrote Paradise Lost, was going to write a long poem about King Arthur. And he actually started to work on it and then decided, no, I'm going to go for the story of the fall and justify the ways of God to man. So he abandoned the Arthur project in favor of Paradise Lost. Arthurian scholars everywhere really kind of wish that he had gone with the Arthur thing.
Right. Wow. That would be that'd probably be the new crown or the title prize winner of all Arthurian stories if it came out. There's been so many iterations, and then there are Arthur stories going into what Alfred Lord Tennyson writes and Mark Twain and Victorian era. And even the new Transformers movie starts with King Arthur, which I have not seen because I'm not 14 years old. But so in the weirdest places, King Arthur keeps popping up. So to tie all these things in together, why do you think probably for the rest of human history, Arthur will keep appearing? What does it say about him? But maybe as a society, what does it say about our society, and then other societies have made use of him?
Well, I would say, you know, at the end, we all need heroes, and that Arthur can become any kind of hero. He can be the noble, fully formed leader, like the Clive Owen Arthur in that movie, or he can be someone who comes from nothing, in some versions, to rise to power. And in every case, he's there to help, to make the world better. And so every age, I think, is going to remake Arthur. It's never going to stop. And I often ask my students, I say, tell me another figure of myth and legend that is as well known and as popular throughout the world and throughout time. And really the closest we get is Jesus. And of course, I always have a student every year who wants to do his or her final project on a research paper on how Arthur is like a Christ figure, because, you know, there's this prophecy he's going to come again. And I say, go ahead, go off and do your research and do that paper. And they honestly think they're the first person to come up with this idea. And then they come back and they're very disappointed. They say, there are 1,000 articles about how Arthur is a messiah and a Christ figure. And I say, yeah, that's okay. You can still write your paper. But good for you for coming up with that all on your own. But that's what he is. And I think that's part of his attraction, is not just what he stood for, but there's always this hope, this idea that, you know, supposedly in Britain's greatest hour of need, Arthur would return and save her. You know, during World War II, there were all these movies that came out that talked about how Arthur was going to come back and essentially help defeat the Nazis. And so every age wants that, a hero who's waiting in the wings, ready to come back, and can be what you need him to be, whenever you need him to be it.
Well, the good news is it'll make your scholarship timeless. And
I know. Yeah, I picked well, didn't I?
Yeah. So there's definitely plenty of popular interest. So there's a lot to that. You'll have probably movies to enjoy for many years to come that try to put their own spin on it. So, yeah, thank you for joining us. And your course is King Arthur, History and Legend, which I will include in the show notes for this episode so people can take a look at it. Any other resources or other things you'd recommend for people who want to delve more into the legend?
There is online, there's this great project called the Camelot Project based at the University of Rochester. It has all kinds of information. I edit an academic journal called Arthuriana, which publishes articles 4 times a year on all things Arthurian, from the Middle Ages to modern interpretations. And there's any number of great books, websites. I mean, Arthur is, I would say, a cottage industry, but he's not. He's an industry. So there's all kinds of stuff out there. If you're looking for basic information, the New Arthurian Encyclopedia, which was edited by Norris Lacy, L-A-C-Y, is also a great place to start to thumb through and learn about the basic elements of the legend.
Great. I'll link all those things out. So, Dorsey, thank you for joining us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show to get your daily dose of all things history related, from ancient Greece to the Cold War. You can do that by going to historyonthenet.com/subscribe. Speaking of History on the Net, if you want to dive deeper, go to our site, historyonthenet.com, and there you'll find blog posts, book reviews, and all of our other podcast episodes. Plus, don't forget to rate and review this podcast so we can bring you the best daily history content possible. We'll see you next time at the History Unplugged podcast.